Hello and welcome to Just Bricks for another week, brought to you by Kick It Forward and the Sporting News Australia. We have a very special guest this week coming up on the program. Derek Fisher, the five-time NBA champion and Lakers favourite, is joining the podcast. He's in Southeast Asia promoting the game, Giorgio, so it's a big get.
I thought for a moment I was your special guest, but Derek Fisher.
You're special.
That counts.
You're special.
We have guest.
We have guests. We definitely have a guest.
One of the guests of all time.
But the best part about it is, and I feel sorry for all the companies in the world right now, because there's a lot of people who are not really watching, not really doing much work, especially in Australia with the time that everything falls. It's NBA playoff time, especially the first round of the playoffs, where there's about three good games every single day. And if there's not three good games, there's about one. We've been pretty blessed early this time.
Pour one out for the companies.
Yeah, they have it so tough. Let's start with some of the highlights this week. On the same day, we had a massive game between Denver and the Lakers, and then also New York and Philly. Both came down to the wire. Both had game winners in them, more so Denver. I had a couple things to point out from it so far. Okay, we'll get to the brothers, Jokic's brothers, in a second. If you're the Lakers, you've got to be upset, because that's your time to steal home court advantage. You got it. LeBron and AD played as good as they possibly could play. They're up by close to 20 points, yeah, and they still lose it.
And they blew it. Jamal Murray with the insane shot. What's the deal with AD in the press conference saying, like, Jamal Murray made a shot and then just walking out?
I guess he was pretty... The funniest bit was he fell into the Denver bench, yes, as time expired. So not only did they pile on Murray, but they inadvertently piled on AD. So that's the first time I've ever seen a pile on inadvertently on the wrong guy.
He's just like, he's like half a foot away from the Nuggets guys. Just like, yeah.
Couple of things to take away from that game. I think the sidelight announcer, that is my most hated thing in NBA, is when there's a it's a really good game. They go to the sideline announcer after a timeout. They speak for 30 seconds, maybe a minute and a half, because this is their time to shine. Meanwhile, there's two of the best buckets also being made while they're still talking about how, I don't know, how the coach has said that defense is really important. It's like, no fucking shit. Can we just go back to the game?
And sometimes they'll minimize the game into an eighth
just
the screen.
For no reason.
Oh, let me just get my binoculars out.
It was a massive game. One thing I wanted to point out, there was the brothers of Nikola Jokic. They've been renowned of being just like these scary Serbian men that attend their brother's games. Now, they're about closer to 40, but you know when you have a movie that involves Eastern Europe, these are the guys. They're 6'6" and 6'9". They're kind of like strong, but like they're not going to weightlifting tournaments. They're going to powerlifting tournaments. They're gigantic. They've got tattoos all over their body. And they're always like very close to the court, so much so whenever there's been an on-court ordeal, it almost looks like they're going to jump the first couple rows and attack those on court. Well, there was an altercation in game two, and it shows, I believe, the older Jokic, Nemanja, punching a Lakers fan in the face.
Yeah, I can't. I'm not sure what was said. Has that been released? What was said?
No, it doesn't show what's said. It just shows like the altercation. I assume they're having a scuffle. I assume they're pretty fired up.
You know what they look like?
What?
Your classic henchmen.
They look like henchmen.
Picture henchmen. That's the Jokic brothers.
It's interesting that Jokic, if he didn't find basketball, he had of a life of being a henchman or riding horses.
Yeah.
The two of them. Interesting to see what happens with that though, because they might not be allowed at the rest of the games. I think there was a brief period where they weren't allowed it, or they didn't really attend Nuggets games for a bit until they sort of calmed down and got into their late 30s. But that's one to watch. That series has been so fun already. The other one I wanted to point out was Hartenstein. He's German-American, but he's had one of the weirdest paths to the NBA I think I've seen. Like he was highly touted. He played German basketball as a junior, won like the national championship in the junior Bundesliga, then signed with a professional team, a Lithuanian team, I believe, or Eastern European team. Stayed there for a bit, eventually got drafted, a bit of a later draft pick, bounced around the NBA before signing a two-year deal with the Knicks, and then all of a sudden now he's producing in front of his, you know, the biggest stage in huge games. He's an offensive rebound to dick out. to dish out to DiVincenzo. And the dime minutes is what basically won the game. Oh, I just wanted a little shout out. I love it when you see Journeyman make a name for himself.
He's normally played like backup centre role, but from a like fantasy point of view, whenever he's the backup centre and the main centre is out, he's just one of those like
what, he'll 10
enormous 10 producers that becomes like a top 20 player that you just jump on immediately.
Also in, the, in my all henchman team.
Oh, yeah, your top five henchmen. Yeah, yeah. Actually, on Dante DiVincenzo's winner, he got the sixth ever Mike Breen double bang.
Really?
Yes. So he got a double bang from Mike
Breen. I did hear the double bang, but where are the other ones? Has he ever done the triple bang?
No. Jesus Christ. No, that'd have to be.
I think I've heard a couple triple bangs.
Growing up.
What does that mean?
Too close to your parents' bedroom. Sorry, they divorced. Wrong pod.
Should we go to some Australian watch?
Yes.
So there's six Australians left playing in the NBA in the postseason. We have Patty Mills, bit of a DNP right now. Josh Giddey, he struggled a little bit in game one, but ended up playing about 19 minutes. But then wasn't really used at the end of the game. Maybe
first
just
ever playoffs for Giddey, right? I mean, he's
But they're a very young team. Nerves. It's not just him. The whole team's young. Then the other one's Dante Exum, 6 minutes for Dallas as they tied the ledger. 14 minutes for Josh Green. He seems like someone who's actually going to play deep into the Mavericks postseason. He had 7 rebounds today. And Iron Eagle. Now, normally there's basketball background in AFL.
But yep.
Well done, Iron Eagle. The famous commentator for the NBA. He's calling out Aussie rules background.
Josh Green played Australian rules football as a youngster, and you could see it in the way he plays out there, the way he throws his body around, and the relentless nature.
I did not know that about him, but yeah, I can definitely see the physicality, the intensity.
Do you reckon they can?
Maybe. No, he rebounds pretty hard. He had those
Reckon they're that. I don't reckon they're that into AFL that they can see similar. I don't know. Yeah, that's a plot twist. Normally, it's a basketball background.
Yeah, changing it up. Just before we move on to hot takes with Chicken Treat, I just want to get your MVP favorite for the season so far.
Oh, I mean the three finalists being Shai, Jokic, and Doncic. You can really mount an argument for all three. It's like, you know, Shai's carried a team to top of the West, OKC. Doncic, Jokic just puts up absurd numbers. Doncic led the average like 36 points. I don't know. I can never go past Jokic, I think.
Yeah, I think it's Jokic for me as well. Let's get to some hot takes brought to you by Chicken Treat and their new Frank's Red Hot Thick Sauce range.
Feeling hot, hot, hot.
Okay, we've already sort of touched on the Australians competing so far. There's six of them. Who do you think out of the Australians will go the furthest in the NBA playoffs?
It has to be Josh Giddey, right? Like, I don't see OKC going down to the Pelicans, although Pelicans might get Zion back if they can make it to Game 5. And, I mean, Pelicans only lost by two. Obviously, Dyson Daniels is on that Pelicans team. He only saw 3 minutes today, but you think Josh Giddey. Otherwise, maybe Josh Green on the Mavericks if Luka and Kyrie can get it together and get past.
This is hot takes, George. You want to keep it succinct. So you're saying Josh Giddey. I'm going to go Josh Giddey as well, unless, of course, Dallas and Doncic pull something together. Okay, number two. What is the best Team USA team ever assembled?
Current one.
The current one. So you say that's better than 1992, the Dream Team, the original Dream Team, or even the Redeem Team?
I do. Maybe Redeem Team. I think the 1992 team was good, but it was all like insane because it was the first ever like pro Olympic team, right? I think the current one is just stacked.
I'm probably going to argue, I think 1992, just because they were all guys in the peak of their powers. They were all the best players in the world, whereas
it's a bit of a throwback now, I suppose. People just passed their prime, like LeBrons and Kawhis and...
Well, I think like now there's a lot of guys like that, but there's also a lot more talent internationally. So there's less players to choose from in the NBA as a result. That's my opinion anyway. That's why it's a hot take, Georgia.
Yep, okay. That's Frank's red hot sauce. That makes sense.
I'd like to hear it. Damian Lillard said he was happy to be back in the playoffs. even though he got to go to Coachella for the last 2 years. Okay, that's great. Do you think Milwaukee are a chance to win the NBA championship?
Yeah, well, what's Giannis's status at the moment?
He had a calf injury today. It says he's out again today. He might be back for game three.
Yeah, I think Milwaukee's one of those teams that they get to the finals and they can win the whole thing with a healthy team. Especially, I mean, they've done it without Dame. Now they have Dame. Absolutely. I think they'd be top three or four for mine.
They can beat Boston?
Yep.
Okay, wow, that's a hot take.
Well, Boston choke every finals, don't they?
Recently they've been choking a fair bit, but no, thanks for stepping in. Remember to go to Chicken Tree, check out their Frank's Red Hot Vic Sauce range. But now we've got a very special interview with Derek Fisher. Do you remember Derek Fisher? Was he one of your favourites growing up or anything like that?
No, I started following NBA about 5 years ago.
Well, for those that don't know, he's been a part of some amazing championships with the Lakers, and he's always accompanying Kobe across those five championships. But he had some major shots. One against Orlando in the second run of championships, and one against the Spurs. Two super clutch shots. They're always compared with like Robert Horry. These guys that hit big shots.
Did he get any Mike Breen bangs?
I think he got some retrospective bang, bang, bangs, yeah.
Oh, okay. He got some bangs, all right.
Make sure you review the podcast and listen on Monday for another Kick It Forward podcast, and have a great Anzac Day long weekend. Welcome, five-time NBA champion, the second most playoff wins in NBA history. Fun fact there. And he's played alongside some of the game's absolute greats. Derek Fisher, thank you for joining the podcast.
No, thank you for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Where do I find you right now? Where in the world are you calling in from?
I am in Seoul, Korea at the moment. It's my first time here on an NBA Asia tour and having a great time, man. It's raining today a little bit, but so far everything's been great.
Oh, unreal. There's a really good South Korean that plays for the team Illawarra in the Australian Basketball League. But what have you made of the basketball in Korea and Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I've heard of the young man you just mentioned, and he's had some great opportunities. I'm sure he's playing well there. The passion for basketball, and like you said, in Southeast Asia is as high as it's ever been, and it's consistently been high. And I think more opportunities, and I hope that there are more opportunities for young boys and girls, you know, from this part of our world that can be rewarded for that passion and love that is there for the game of basketball. And, you know, that's part of the reason why I'm here. Was able to participate in a coach's clinic in Manila, Philippines as well. Just trying to help grow the game, you know, for coaches and players all over the world.
Just on international basketball, right now we're seeing more top-tier international NBA players than ever before. You could argue the top five players in the NBA right now are international players, including Joel Embiid from Africa, and then multiple players from Europe. What do you think the reasoning behind the rise of the international basketballer is in the NBA? And is there any part of that that is a regression on the USA to develop talent? Or is it entirely on international programs improving since, say, the mid-2000s?
No, I think it's a great question. There are people smarter than me that probably have the more accurate answers, I guess, per se. I personally don't necessarily believe that the game has regressed specifically. Yes, the game is taught differently. If you grow up in LA compared to Seoul, you're being taught the game differently, of course. But I also believe the growth of basketball around the world is the most significant contributor to why there are more top players in the NBA that are finding success. You think about the NBA in terms of basketball, was an American sport for the most part until the Dream Team in 1992 in Barcelona. And that kind of changed the way the world consumed basketball. And so, you know, literally for the last 30 years, the world has been on a chase to be just as good as everybody else. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. And so while we would say today the top five players in the league to some degree are internationally born players, I don't think that means basketball in the United States is forever doomed and it has regressed. I just think we have to give more credit to the growth around the world and view it as a positive thing as opposed to a right or wrong thing.
As a former player and seeing this rise of the international player, is there an ego attached to being the dominant country in the NBA like the US? Do you think US players have an ego attached to being the number one? And what do you think the reaction from players is seeing this rise of international basketball being more and more prevalent in their league?
Yeah, no, it's, you know, me being, you know, I'm coaching in high school. I'm not in every, you know, NBA conversation that is happening. From what I can gather, you know, I think there's a tremendous amount of respect for any player from anywhere as long as he can play. I honestly think that, you know, American-born players that are playing at the highest levels in the NBA, those guys want to win. I don't think they're concerned over where their teammate is from necessarily and viewing that as a, you know, their ego is being infringed upon or negatively impacted because a player is coming in and wants to be great as well. My experience has always been great players actually enjoy and embrace being around other players that want to be great. And whether they're from Africa or Australia, if as long as they want to be great and they want to win and they're willing to put in the hours and the time and the work, then we're going to get along just fine. And I think that's how most, you know, American players are today as well, from my perspective.
You started your coaching career with the Knicks and then eventually with the LA Sparks. You're now coaching your sons, is that correct? So I guess your question is, what's it like coaching your sons? And also, where is your head currently at as far as your future in professional coaching?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a joy to, you know, have the opportunity to coach, you know, my sons this past year in high school, you know, really trying to provide every opportunity I have to not just my sons, but, you know, just young guys in this generation of American high school basketball. You know, just information and knowledge that I gained and gathered from my playing career and coaching professionals and trying to offer it to them as much as possible. While trying to also make sure that we don't kill each other at the dinner table, you know, as far as my sons and I. But it was really enjoyable. You know, I'm looking forward to moving, you know, into my second year there. You know, my oldest son is graduating high school, so it'll be two guys. Two of my sons will still be there on the team. And, you know, I'm excited. I'm thankful. As far as coaching, you know, moving forward in the future, I just want to continue to learn and grow as a coach. I think I've always viewed, you know, even when I played, but in particular as a coach, just having a growth mindset and wherever there are opportunities to continue to grow and learn information and be around the best, learn from the best. That's the way I'm looking at coaching now. And so right now I'm coaching high school basketball. You know, I'll allow time, you know, God, the universe, to kind of let that figure out what I'll be doing next. I know I love the game. I love coaching and teaching. And so if there are opportunities at the professional level to do so, those are things that I'll look forward to at that time.
When you look back at the baptism by fire of the start of your coaching career now, and the way you had to jump from being a player straight to a coach, it's just somewhat unfathomable for me, even though it's the same field of basketball, to go from a completely different job, a point guard, a player, to a head coach in a city like New York, which is under the microscope in such a big way. What would you do differently, you think, now, whether that's not necessarily just on-court X's and O's, but off-court as well, and how you interact with everyone? How would you go about it differently, if at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think in hindsight, you know, like you said, like it is a difficult transition to make. And there are still things, you know, even now, a decade later, that I'm still learning intentionally. And I've always approached coaching from that perspective of, you know, I don't have all the answers and have never pretended to have all the answers. And so, you know, I think in hindsight, I think the relationships that you can directly build with your players is probably the most important aspect of coaching. The X's and O's, the strategy, the tactical parts, you know, that's a collaborative effort that you should be kind of going through with your coaching staff and other coaching support and resources that, you know, you can get that almost anywhere. But if you are one of the rare coaches that have that gift and that ability to really build genuine relationships with your players, in hindsight, that's the thing that I feel like took me the longest to connect to. Going from being a player and being in the locker room to being a coach, I've struggled for years understanding how do you break that barrier. And ultimately, it's just basically two people getting to know each other. And as a coach, you have to want to get to know your players at a really high level. And that's something that I'm continuing to work on every single day.
But you've coached in the NBA, the WNBA, now high school boys. Is it the same that what you've learned about coaching, regardless of the level and the league?
Yes. Yeah. That is the one consistent and transcendent aspect of coaching that I think matters more than anything. I believe there are some things that, from a basketball perspective, you know, some things will work, you know, in the NBA, the WNBA, and high school, right? You have to communicate on defense. You know, you have to have good spacing. You have to share the ball. Like, there are consistencies you could talk about all day there. But some things don't work. You can't use the exact same strategies at all three levels. But the one part that you have to do in order to be successful at the pro level, men, women, high school level, grassroots, you have to be able to care and about your players, serve your players, but really build relationships that help them understand you're in this for them and with them. It's not an easy thing to do. I think in particular with young players and just a new generation of players, but it's something that the great coaches, you know, they do the best, and that's something that we all have to continue to learn.
Let's talk about your time at the Sparks in the WNBA. It started really, really strong in LA. Australians have a really love-hate relationship with Liv Cambage. I think a lot of us deep down really just want her to see her playing her best basketball for Australia and without the off-field controversies. You had her in 2022 when sort of the wheels were falling off completely off the wagon after the great Olympic ordeal. What did you make as a head coach of Liz? Because that's a relationship that the public, despite all the media coverage, aren't really privy to.
Yeah, no, I think the point you make is spot on. You know, Liz, during the time I got a chance to work with her, she really is a really amazing human being. Like she is someone that you want to do well. Like you said, you want to see the best of her from a basketball perspective. But just like any human being, whether he or she plays basketball or does other things in life, you know, when there are things that as a person you're still navigating and trying to figure out for yourself, it is hard to be the best version of yourself on the court or in your profession or, you know, at your craft. And so, you know, I think Liz, admittedly at times, you know, is a person that wants to continue to get better. I know she wanted to work on specific things that would allow her to play her best basketball. But like many of us, like that's not something that it just happens because you say you want it to happen, or even if you're doing some work at it, it takes time. And so ultimately, basketball is only one part of someone's identity, Liz included. And so the main thing is, you know, however long she's able to play basketball and for at whatever level, you just want her to be happy and you want her to be fulfilled as a person. And, you know, you want the best for her. And that's the way I've always viewed, you know, my time working with Liz and then even in following her journey up to now.
Just one more WNBA question before we turn to the NBA. I know you're very busy. Caitlin Clark taken with the number one pick in the WNBA draft. We've seen the amount of attention she got through the, her final NCAA season. Do you think the WNBA has enough support for a player like her, a star like her, to nurture her stardom and give her the best platform possible? Is it still the WNBA?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, any great sports league, you know, the sustainability of it is directly tied to the greatness and excellence of the players that are in it. You know, you track the history of the NBA, things significantly changed as certain players came into the league. And then as they came into the league and then sustained their elite and excellent level of play, you know, the league was able to grow. More fans wanted to watch, more people wanted to support because of the play on the court, you know, not us just talking about wanting it to grow. And so I think that movement has been happening slowly over the last few years. I would argue that the pandemic was somewhat disruptive to a young and upcoming business like the WNBA. You know, it's still in a very early phase when you compare it to some of our other major sports. And so as everyone continues to kind of move away from the more burdensome parts of the pandemic, I think the time couldn't be more better for a transcendent young star to come into the WNBA, similar to the transcendent young star that came into the NBA in Victor Wembanyama. You know, those things ignite fan bases, it ignites media partners, it ignites sponsors in a way that it's not just because we say we wanted to, it's because of how great the player is. And Caitlin Clark looks like she has the potential to not just change the bottom line on the business side, but she's a really good basketball player as well. And that's ultimately the most sustainable part that is needed, that she can play great basketball for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years and be someone that we can point to as a real, a needle mover in women's basketball and for the WNBA.
I saw what you recently said about the Lakers potentially upsetting the Nuggets in the playoffs in the first round. What makes you think they're better placed this year compared to last year to pull off an upset and end the Nuggets from the position they're in?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Lakers, you know, I think Anthony Davis is who comes to mind in terms of, you know, matching up against Nikola Jokic and not really necessarily, you know, stopping him. The terms that we often use with, you know, disrupting player success. But Anthony Davis has had an elite defensive season. And I think that is something that, you know, will prove to be difficult for the Nuggets to figure out is Anthony Davis's presence on the defensive end. So that's what comes to mind first, is that I think AD's playing defense at a higher level than he was a year ago. Two, I think the Lakers are shooting the ball at a higher level than they were a season ago. Really struggled to shoot the three consistently throughout the regular season, and for sure in that series against the Nuggets, there was not enough perimeter three-point shooting that D'Angelo, Austin Reeves, some of the other perimeter guys were able to offer. And I think that's something that is going to be different this year. I think D'Angelo, Austin, Rui Hachimura, those guys are shooting the ball well and have shot the ball well all season. I think that's something they can carry into the postseason. With the Nuggets, I mean, I don't think they got worse necessarily. I mean, Jokic probably will be the MVP again based on most people's votes. You know, Jamal Murray had a great year. He got a chance to kind of get some rest and get himself healthy as the regular season wound down. But the Nuggets kind of had a sneaky depth last year that I'm not sure is still there. Jeff Green, Bruce Brown. Those were guys that contributed significantly to the Denver Nuggets playoff and championship run last year. Those guys aren't there now. So puts more emphasis on Christian Brown and Peyton Watson and Reggie Jackson and some of the guys that weren't heavy contributors in the postseason last year per se. And that's where I think the Lakers specifically could maybe take advantage of the Nuggets in terms of that lack of depth. But we'll see. Can't wait for the series to start.
Josh Giddey, probably our strongest Australian postseason player. He's been a huge part of the Oklahoma City Thunder, a team that you were a part of during their other bright period with Kevin Durant, some future Hall of Famers, Russell Westbrook. Do you believe this team has similarities to that former Thunder side in the fact they were just prior or on the cusp of heading to the to do something potentially in the postseason? And is there any chance this Thunder side could do something earlier than anticipated, much like that team? And what do you think Josh Giddey's role will be?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the similarities, I guess, when you think about Chet and Holmgren and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and then Josh Giddey, like those three guys kind of being foundational players and then surrounded by just, you know, quality young role guys that, you know, they seem to have a good way about them as a team. People seem to be comfortable with their roles. They aren't kind of battling each other and trying to figure out who they are. They seem to have a good sense of who they are. And Josh Giddey deserves a lot of credit for that. I think he's done a good job of kind of balancing his game out. And, you know, there are nights where he scores a little bit more, but, you know, he's kind of on triple-double watch most nights where it's, you know, 14, 15 points, 9 or 10 assists, 7, 8, 9 rebounds. And those are good leadership qualities that are needed, you know, with championship-caliber teams. There's not a ton of postseason experience, you know, mixed into that group. I think that's the one challenge that they could face is when you're trying to win four playoff series, it's important to have some people that have been through it before that can help on the court, of course, in terms of, you know, understanding some things that need to be done on the court, but also just in the locker room and helping keep the right mindset and perspective as you go through the ups and downs of a playoff series. But it's been fun to watch. I personally, if I had a vote, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander would be my MVP. But, you know, Josh Giddey, you know, I think, you know, he quietly has had just a really good season. And I think the Thunder have as good a chance, you know, as anybody to, you know, try to challenge the Nuggets. I mean, if they face off, OKC will have home court advantage. And that's kind of the one kryptonite that you might be able to use against the Nuggets if you can, you know, if you can kind of get at them outside of Denver and take away some of that home court advantage.
Guys like yourself, Robert Horry, Steve Kerr, players from that era that were always so ready when they came on court to hit huge shots. Have you ever come together, whether it was over a beer or something, and discussed the similarities between you two and you three and your playing styles, particularly you and Horry? Whether that's preparation or mindset or anything at all, because it's such a unique skill set, but surely it can't be a coincidence that certain people have come together and had these similar playing moments throughout their career where they could just be ready to make huge impacts. Have you ever discussed it whatsoever? Because I'd be interested to know.
Yeah, no, I mean, Robert and I do get to talk often because we both live in the Los Angeles area. You know, our sons were playing high school basketball against each other this year. So, you know, we've spoken a lot, but not specifically along this lane. I think you might be onto something. I think Robert and I, Steve, you know, we should start a podcast. You can host it and we can have these conversations okay. All over the world about, you know, how special you have to be. I mean, you know, I think for me, what comes to mind is, like you said, that era of guys and what our experiences were before those moments. You know, we came up at a time where there was a little bit less expectation and entitlement to be in those positions, right? Like we weren't in high school assuming that we would be the top pick in the NBA draft. Whereas as the game has grown, there are more young people around the world that see themselves being in these positions. And so we approached every basketball moment as though we have to execute at a high level in order to prove that we belong here. If we don't do our jobs well, we may not be here next year. And so there was a level of readiness and professionalism that was absolutely required from us in order for us to even have a chance to be on the court. And so in those clutch moments, yeah, I think in those clutch moments, it wasn't that we necessarily were doing something supernatural or that other people aren't capable of. I think we were just being consistently who we are. And that's what allows us to kind of just be calm and execute in that moment, because we aren't trying to be something that we already don't exist to be every single day. And that's ready, focused, dedicated, committed. And that's how you execute in the biggest moments.
You played alongside one of the all-time greats, Kobe Bryant. It'd be remiss for me not to ask one question about him. You're coaching now. What is one thing you've taken from the period where you played with Kobe that which you tried to instill in the guys you coach today?
Yeah, I mean, the number one thing that I try to offer young players today that I thought, you know, Kobe embodied the most is he was always willing to learn and grow and get better. You know, I think many players, they want to go put some shots up. You know, they want to go to the gym. But Kobe was relentless in his learning of the game and his growth in the game and being a student of the game. Never approached the conversation from as though he already knew the answer. And that made him coachable, even though he was great. It made him a great teammate, even though he was individually great. And so I just try to kind of offer that to young players all the time. Like, don't ever assume that, you know, you know what's supposed to be happening. Like, it's not your coach's responsibility to, you know, give you the answers to something. You have to be curious. You have to go and ask. You have to do the work. It's your career. It's your journey. Is your legacy. And I think Kobe really embodied those things in a tremendous way.
Derek, I could speak to you for 10 hours. Thank you so much for your time coming on today. I know you've got a lot of these to do today.
Thank you,
brother. I really appreciate you making the time. Cheers, Derek.
I appreciate it, man. Take care.